Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Pedro Nassif, the innovative chief technology officer at the Helicopter Company, who is revolutionizing the aviation sector with his expertise in digital transformation. With an MBA and over 18 years of experience in tech leadership across diverse sectors, Pedro is a master in driving technological advancements and business growth. His journey includes transforming Agro Solutions as its CEO and CIO, where he achieved remarkable growth and operational efficiency. Pedro's skills in process improvement, agile methodologies, and cloud migration are just a few highlights of his extensive portfolio. I've asked him to join us here today to share his story and dive into the world of digital technology, sharing insights on everything from aviation tech to corporate travel and beyond, all while pushing the boundaries of what's possible in the digital realm. Pedro, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing, my friend?
Good morning, Daryl. Pleasure to be here. Everything's good.
Yeah, good. It's an honor and pleasure to have you. Now, before we hop into some of the techie stuff and business stuff, how did you even get started in business? Do you come from a family of entrepreneurs? Are you following in your parents' footsteps of entrepreneurship in the corporate world?
I would say that I had some influence from my dad. My dad was an engineer, an electric engineer that turned into a computer engineer in the 70s and 80s. And I think he had a positive influence on the things I wanted to do with my life. On the side, he always tried to run a business as well. So he had an import and export business in France. Didn't work out though. In the end, I think he was a better engineer than he was a businessman. We need to find our calling. So that had an influence on me. And I think in the end, that's why I follow the path I have.
So how did your career start out then? What were your earliest kind of experiences?
I started working for a technology for fixed income company in Berlin. I did my studies as a computer engineer in Brazil. And then sometime just after I graduated, I went to Berlin, worked there for almost a year. It was fantastic because of the change in culture and the opportunity to collaborate with different people with different mindsets. Then it was very cool, but I decided to go back to Brazil because I missed the football and the beer at the end of it. And that was what, and obviously the girlfriend would then became my wife. Not if I don't mention that, I'm going to have my ears pulled just after that podcast.
Yeah.
yeah. So no, it's the love of my life, so I can't say anything else. But look, what happened was then I started working in Brazil again, worked in technology for agriculture, got involved with exciting stuff such as our artificial intelligence for precision agriculture. Basically, that involved taking pictures of fields, processing those images, looking for patterns of diseases, for instance, based on the images, looking for patterns of areas that would require further fertilizing and stuff like that. Then we would plot that into maps, right? Geographical maps. So they would have lat longs and all that stuff. And they would be layered. And then based on that, you would be able to see various levels of information and advise the business person where and what the person needed to do with his field. And that was like, we're talking early 2000s. Back then, we didn't, you know, this is pre-mobile era. This is pre-hype GPU AI era. And we were already doing neural networks back then and image processing. It was pretty cool. So I started working in that field and I found it was fascinating, the whole aspect of it. But the business didn't do quite well because I think we were a bit ahead of our time. The field, the folks at the field didn't have an infrastructure, for instance, for internet that was good enough for us to get the images and then be able to process this and give them the required feedback on time. So it created many logistical problems that we didn't anticipate before. So the venture didn't do quite well. So I went back to financial markets, worked a stint in Sao Paulo at the Treasury for Santander, then went to do an MBA in France. Then started again working with technology for financial markets, so equity derivatives in London, buy side and sell side. So in other words, investment banks and hedge funds. And I would provide the technology that would allow them to do portfolio management, risk management, P&L management, you name it. So that went on and it was pretty cool as well because the math behind it is cool. And it was quite exciting for a while, the challenges that came from data. But then I think I had a crisis of faith after the 2008, 2009 financial crisis. I started asking myself what it is I do here in terms of building system to price those very complicated financial instruments, multi-underlying assets with whatnot payoff that has just been created by some guys in the quant team. And how do you explain that to your kids at home? So look, maybe I'll go do something else. And then funny enough, I used to play football in London with a friend of mine. He was CEO at a fund, and he had a friend who needed somebody to look after his technology. And the person, however, was really working in business aviation. So it had absolutely nothing to do with what I was doing, but he felt he would be a good match from a personality point of view. That's when I got involved with VistaJet, and that was back in 2011, I think. And it was a small operation out of Salzburg in Austria. And then the whole thing grew to we were 19 aircraft when we started. And by the time I left, the company has grown significantly. It went from narrow body to wide body. It was a very interesting experience in terms of growth and also providing systems that would allow that growth to happen. That was very interesting. But again, after 7 years that were very interesting, very intense, I think I also had another crisis of faith. And I said, look, maybe it's time for me to do something else. Went back to Brazil. I wanted my kids to know their country. Two of my three kids were born in the UK.
Right.
But I wanted them to know more about their roots and their family in Brazil. So back 2019, I went back to Brazil. That was the tail end of it. Maybe in November, December, started working for Argo Solutions. It's an Amadeus company. Amadeus is a big travel technology conglomerate. And started as a chief information officer there and was then promoted to CEO afterwards. But the funny thing is that at the end of 2019 came the pandemic, and I suddenly found myself locked in Brazil. It wasn't really the plan. The plan was to stay there a while. But then suddenly you're there, you're stuck. People said, look, it's just going to go only until, I don't know, April. And then the world's going to be back to normal.
Again.
And then there you go. So that's a long story short, but being around, and I mean, I jumped some steps. Like I lived in Malta for a while, as well as part of the VistaJet group, which was also interesting, creating a unit out of nothing. So we started operations there out of a clean piece of paper. So a lot of things that happened were driven off this need for adrenaline and growth. And I think that's why I have been around quite a bit.
Right. That's an exciting story. I had some things you talked about there in your experience that I wanted to dive into. First was remote agile teams. Can you discuss that in terms of, I think some people listening, most people probably know agile, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that's a sprint methodology, right? That's doing fast iterations on product development, whether it's lead gen, whatever part of the business you want to work on, it's creating a definite, I think it's a 2-week block, fast iteration projects. Is this true? And you say you help run these with remote teams internationally. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's actually quite exciting because coordinating people of different locations, geographically, different cultures, culture ends up being is a reference system, right? So you value things differently. You perceive things differently depending on your culture. So that's quite a challenge. So the thing that united most of us doing the work was actually being in love with the tech and with engineering. So you have the culture of engineering permeating most of the things that you do. And that was a common denominator. But we had teams in the Middle East, teams in East Europe, teams in Brazil, and then obviously in Europe. So coordinating the efforts with everybody working on the same set of products, it's quite an achievement, I must say. Looking back, the tangible products, it's cool. You create products, it helps the business generate more revenue, it helps with the bottom line. When you look back at the how you've done that, it's also quite an achievement. But back to your question on Agile. So Agile it's a set of methodologies that want to help people produce products in a faster and higher, in a higher quality way. If you take historically the way things were produced, it would be people would have a requirements phase, so they would sit down with the customer, understand what it is the customer wants, and then only then they would finish what it's called like a spec, a specification. It would have all the details in it, and then they would go on and do the design of it, and then they would go on and do the implementation or coding of it, go on and do the testing of it, and then they would go on and go do the deployments of it, And the whole cycle was so long that by the time you got to implementation, the requirement has changed already because the world has changed all the time. Right, people change their mind, and then it would no longer be applicable. So I think the agile methodology, I mean, you've got Kanban, you've got Scrum, and there are many ways, extreme programming, there are a lot of things that you can do, but in essence, they all share the same principle that you want to iterate. You want to do smaller increments faster. You want to reduce the red tape. The documentation has to be kept to a minimum. You want to promote human interaction as opposed to documentation writing. So there is a manifest that describes the agile key ideas. It's quite interesting. I think if you read it, you'll see that it's fairly common sense, but it basically emphasizes human interaction over certain sort of very bureaucratic processes that permeate development.
I wanted to ask, and because there's a couple of things. First, the international component, different time zones, different cultures, as you mentioned, different markets. Then there's the remote team aspect of it. And since the pandemic, a lot of people have been trying to do work from home. My personal philosophy is you really need a hybrid model as best as you can. But I wanted to ask for yourself, either what were some of the biggest challenges or what would you recommend to someone struggling, trying to do agile sprints with a remote international team? Can you speak to that?
I would say that the challenge is people. People are different. They want to be heard. They want to feel contributing to the objective. And how do you do that when you're not meeting the person? You can't have a coffee with the person. You can do virtual coffees, but let's be honest, it's not the same thing. So what I would recommend is promoting communication and people meetups. When I say meetups, it's not necessarily the online version. It's really having, as long as it's possible financially, people to meet with each other and then be able to just debate things from time to time. The hybrid model, I believe it's the best. I would agree with you. I think the pandemic, also I'm biased because I used to work with the travel technologies. By definition, I want people to meet themselves with their friends and everything. But I think that there is an element that was lost during the pandemic, which is to be around the whiteboard, debating and brainstorming ideas, and doing that yields so much value. And then we lost that component when we started doing only Zoom meetings and team meetings and all that stuff. But that said, there are moments where you don't want to be disturbed and you do want to focus on getting your stuff done. So I think that what I would say is I would promote people meeting each other with each other. I would promote communication events. I would promote ensuring that people are heard and not just like a random number in a geographical dispersed location that is producing something for the firm. That's what I would say.
Yeah, okay. So more feedback, more communication, more meetups, more kind of sharing and I guess getting people involved. Trying to make sure that if they are on Zoom, that they're on the meeting with you and not. One thing I hate is I hate when everyone is on mute and they ask a question and it takes forever for someone to get off mute and talk. Because that would it wouldn't happen. In a room, everyone would be staring at them like they're an idiot because it's taken them 3 minutes to acknowledge what you said and replied. So I think that's a big part of it is to try to just as best you can make sure everyone's present. They're not on their phones. They're not on other tabs. That they're there with you while you're having the meeting. I think that's a really important factor. You talk about developing growth systems. What is a growth system? How do you develop a system in a business that works?
Well, I think you need to look, every business is different. So I'm going to be just giving people recipes on how to do that. But I think there are elements that you could try and abstract. I think it's all about capacity building, right? Growth is a lot about capacity building. So you have different challenges. If you are a mature company, then if you're a growth company. If you're a growth company, you probably have more demand than you can serve. You probably are seeing cracks appearing almost everywhere. It has that feeling of chaos. And then you come in, especially when you talk about systems and IT systems specifically, there is this feeling of changing a part of a plane whilst the plane is flying. So the plane is flying, and then actually it's not only flying, it's taking off. And then you're there and then you're swapping parts.
Like, hey, we got to replace the engine. What?
And I got to replace the engine. But don't worry, it's just the left one. The right one is still there. So people get a bit anxious about it, rightly, because change is disruptive. But that's what I would say. It's about finding out what are the processes and the tools that will allow you create capacity. That's number one. And then second is understanding what's the shortcut in change management to help people embrace that change, because you won't do it on your own. It's not you with your squad that will go there. And then, no, the guy in sales needs to be in, the guy in operations needs to buy the idea, and so on and so forth. So it's a collaboration, and you need to do a lot of convincing, because it's hard. The guy's already stressed because he has to cope with the high demand. So that's what I would say. It's about finding the right tools, finding the right processes, and then dealing rightly with people. That's what I would summarize it in. But obviously, different businesses would have different the challenges, right?
Mm. No, I agree. I think that's great. So the analogy is, I think there's some really good feedbacks there in terms of growth systems. It's capacity building. So I often, when I work with people, I talk about the rule of 10,000. How would you generate 10,000 leads? How would you respond to 10,000 leads? How would you properly qualify 10,000 leads? And this sort of building, this sort of thinking you think about when you look at your whole customer journey, essentially. You map out your customer journey experience. You think about all the back end things that have to happen around supporting that experience. And you think about, what if we had 10,000 people coming through each part of this, and where are those bottlenecks, and how do we adjust and fix those? I love what you talk about capacity building, because in the theory of constraints, wherever your bottleneck is, more energy and effort anywhere else is a diminished ROI on your time, energy, right? And in terms of fixing it. And I love that you mentioned, just you put it on the table, you're like, this is going to feel chaotic, and it's going to feel like changing parts of the plane while it's in flight. And I think that's great, because I think a lot of people live in the future. I know I'm probably guilty of this myself. When we get to this destination, then we'll do that. And sometimes that's okay, but perhaps that's one of those things that has to be discussed and debated with the team, because some things, maybe it should be fixed now versus delay when more layers of complexity have now been added on top of that. So I think those are really...
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then there is an element there that's super important, and maybe is one of the greatest challenges that I feel executives face, is that trade-off between the today and the tomorrow, the short terms versus long-term commitments, because you have only so much resources to deploy. And then you have to make that call between spending on today, the short term, and the long term. And especially in technology, we are by definition people who love talking about the future and the vision and how it's going to be great. And then I had this funny meeting with the board at THC, and we were presenting the IT strategy. And then at some point, the guy said, "That's all very nice and good, but what about the quick wins? What about the today's deliverable?" It all felt a bit like a pie in the sky, but we need to get to show a path between today and that vision. And that must, right, that path must be full of small wins along the way, milestones. Right. And it's a powerful message. The guys are smart, and they're there for a reason. And the thing is you know, sometimes you get caught up on, it's going to be great, we're going to deploy those AI great tools, and it's going to do this, we're going to do predictive maintenance in the business, we're going to do demand generation using X, Y, and Z technology. And then you suddenly find out that, look, but before you can run, let us walk, and then there is this crack here, you got to fix it, right?
Yeah, especially with software, I've really come around maybe more times than I want to admit, you just have to crawl, walk, run with a lot of software systems. Running forward to automate things can be supportive, but you just have to be really careful and have high touch and oversight of things. Because I've seen people get a million impressions and no sales. So like garbage in, garbage. If you automate a process that doesn't work, all you have is a high volume. It's like cold email is an easy example. If you have a cold email campaign that does not work and you add 100,000 people to it, you just have 100,000 people who hate you now. You really got to get... Just because you automated, this is going to be great. I'm going to automate everything in my calendar link. But just because you automated it, there's no benefit to it. And so the fundamentals, it's that crawl, walk, run. And I love when you talk about what is the system. It's tools, processes, and team buy-in. And I think there has to be, maybe we should add tracking to that. I'm going to write that down in my notes. Tracking to make sure that it's, because if you don't measure it, you can't manage it. And if you can't manage it, you can't fix or grow or improve it. So I think that's a really important one to include. So what is a system in your business? It's the tools, process, the team, and tracking required to accomplish something. I think that's really important, because your business is a system with a lot of sub-components, and you have to think about your business like that and get out of just it being in your business, putting out fires, running around all the time, to take the time to look at your business as almost like a software tool on its own or as a machine. And I analyze each piece individually, and then try to make an assessment. If you want, you could do a SWOT analysis for each component. And then after that, you have to figure out what's the biggest bottleneck at this point. and double down all efforts on that. Because again, effort anywhere else, and a lot of times I think for a lot of new businesses, this is my opinion, but I think it's a well-researched opinion, is a lot of that is they're just not generating the lead volume that they need, the leads and the sales. For most businesses, they really need to invest heavily in sales assets, whether it's just partnerships, or, and I'm speaking for even what I need at this point too, more partnerships, more marketing, more lead generation, lead qualification, and more bringing more people in. I think that's a huge, especially as we walk into, you talked about some uncertain times, the 2008, 2009 financial crisis, but now we know that the world is headed towards some turbulence in the near future, perhaps, that I think that these things are going to be more important than ever. And it's double your quality and quadruple your efforts to onboard new clients. And I think that's going to be really important. The people that cut back, that get timid, that do less, that stay still, stay static, I think they're just going to get washed out with the change.
I definitely agree. I think that if you think about it, you need to at least learn and change at the same pace as your environment changed. And look out there. It's crazy how fast it's changing. So yeah. Not changing, it just means that you will go, by definition, you will go behind. And not even not changing at a slow pace means that by definition, you may be left behind. There's so much happening out there. But one thing you mentioned that caught my attention, I think is pretty important, is that sometimes we have limited resources and we deploy it and we don't see the result we were expecting. You're investing in some top of the funnel sort of investment and it doesn't pay off. You're not really converting it. And I think that there is a lot of that going around. And especially when you're talking about tools and technologies, sometimes we get a bad rep, and rightly, because a lot of investment doesn't yield result. Why? Because people do it for the hype of it, right? Oh, they're using Gen AI. Let us use Gen AI for everything. Guys, but the first question is, from a business point of view, what pain is this going to solve for you? And then maybe you will have the pain, and maybe it's rightly applicable. And I do think it's transformational. I'm not saying otherwise. Right. But I'm saying that sometimes we jump onto it just because it's cool. And I've done that. I'm an engineer, so I love that, doing that kind of thing as well. But the thing is, you soon realize that you're having the page view, the page impression, but you're not having the sale. And then you got to pay the bill. So I think that understanding your chain, your value chain, and where the bottlenecks are, like you say, it's really important, because you only have limited resources and you need to find out where you're going to deploy them. And then those, just identifying where the bottlenecks are and working on them, spending the energy and the money there, that's what's going to yield the greatest result. And sometimes we don't do that, then you get crap return on your technology investment, or any investment for that matter.
Yeah, I agree. I really love this talk I heard from Greg Glassman, who is the founder of CrossFit. And he was talking about how ultimately markets are unknown and unknowable. I bring this up a lot because I think it's just so important, because we've seen this happen in newspapers. We've seen it happen in the music industry. We saw newspapers when the internet came out, the music industry, we're seeing with mainstream media right now. And so markets are ultimately unknown and unknowable. If I ask you how many people are shopping for a car today, you could find indicators, keyword searches, that, but ultimately it's unknown and unknowable because it fluctuates constantly. But everyone can acknowledge and recognize excellence. So if you really know what problem you're solving for the market, and you know that there's a need for that problem to be solved in the market, and your obsession is about being the most excellent solution for that problem, that can see you through a lot of ups and downs. Even if you look at Elon, what he's done with his companies, they just obsess about being the best and iterating fast. I've heard him talk about not needing marketing. Not everyone's Elon Musk, and he does a lot of marketing, even though he doesn't call it advertising. He does a lot of things to get organic, and not everyone can be Elon. So I think you still need to advertise and get out there and get your name out there 100%. But I think it's really a really good philosophy that you just need to obsess about being the most excellent and constantly beating that drum, because everybody can recognize it. And to talk about your value chain and the bottlenecks, that really what matters is what people want. At the end of the day, we are, our boss is our customer and we serve them. And so as long as we are deeply tied to them, connected to them, we know what they want. We know what options they have available, and we make sure the pioneers get the arrows, the settlers get the lands. You don't necessarily want to set up a food stand on a road that isn't built yet. You just want to be at a busy intersection and be the best out of all the options at that corner, I think is a good way to put it. And I think that's a really good message there. What are some of the specific skills or behaviors you believe are important for your staff to develop or improve moving into the unknown future?
I would say that the ability to learn. We're talking about the world changing fast, yep. Technology in particular. I think staff, everybody, myself included, need to have a mindset of constantly learning. I know it sounds like a cliche, but you need to go back home every day, look yourself in the mirror after your shower and say, what have I learned new today? And then if you end up answering too many times, look, I'm not learning, something's got to change fundamentally in the way you're carrying out your life, because some learning is fundamentally important. One thing that always struck me as inconsistent with reality is, think about life, right? We, at least where I lived before, you would spend the first 20% of your life studying, learning 100% of your time. And then the 80% remaining, you would spend just exploiting that skill that you have acquired over time.
Right.
And then it assumes that the world is, you got prepared for a task, and then that's going to stay constant. And then you go on and do that. Silly question, but how many hours, how many weeks in a year does the average Joe spend learning?
Yeah.
I would say not even, if you say 2 weeks, it's already... what, 5% of your time? How is that possible with the rest of our lives? We don't even spend, because I would say most people would not spend 2 weeks learning, but 5% of their time learning. So to me, I think that the number one advice I would give to everybody is get learning. And today, look, I used to queue, my wife and I in Paris, I studied there. I used to queue at the library to spend my weekends reading. And I say queue because it was a huge queue on Sundays for us to get in, because so many people wanted to get in, and we would be there and we would get the books and we would read, and it would be a great atmosphere, have a little coffee, although they would want us to do it in the cafeteria, but that's something else. We'd like to be where the books were. And then, okay, it was kind of nice and a nice experience, but it was difficult. You had to go out on your Sunday, queue up, then go into the library and all that stuff. Today, you open your phone, you've got everything in your fingertips. You go into, I don't know, those MOOC courses, right? Massive online open courses. You get for $50 courses out of the best universities in the world. There is really low barrier to learning today. It just depends on us changing the mindset and getting away from this 20%, 100% of the time, 80%, 0% of the time learning, and going to a constant learning process. So that's number one. Sorry, I went on a tangent there. The number two, I would say, is resilience. I don't remember having achieved anything of meaning and of value in my life that came easy. You have to persist, and you've been knocked down, then you stand up, and then you go at it again, and then until it works. And technology projects, the meaningful ones, they are challenging, and it requires grit. So I think that's number two. Is sometimes I feel people, oh, that's hard, I'll just give up. No, there is an element of assessing whether you're on the right path, and you need to reassess. I'm not saying you have to just blindly go, but you need to also, when people need to understand that sometimes things are tough, and then you have to continue and you have to persist until the job is done. Execution eats strategy for lunch. That's the way it works.
So I love that. Execution eats strategy for lunch. That's right. I like that. I like that a lot. I like that a lot. I agree. We're talking about the library card. Jim Rohn is the godfather of the personal development movement. He used to have a talk where he'd say, how many Americans have a library card? 3%. This is pre-internet. He said 3% can access all the knowledge of the world, solve all your life problems, and only 3% of Americans have a library card. And he goes on this big rant of walk away from the 97%. Don't walk their walk. Don't talk their talk. Don't be like the 90%. Don't use their vernacular. Walk away from the 97%, join the 3%, the ones that are obsessed about learning, because they say there's nothing new under the sun. We're inventing and developing a lot of things, but the principles, the tactics frequently change, the strategies sometimes change, but the principles never really change. And so a lot of times you can especially talk about how connected we are. You and I are in different countries, different sides of the planet, essentially, and we're connected now with Zoom. The world is so hyper-connected. You just reach out and find the world's greatest expert in X, ask them some questions, solve your problem, move on. Now that we have the internet, the world has a nervous system, and we're throwing off the shackles of censorship. And we had crony capitalism, but we also had crony information, freedom of flow of information. And we're really fighting that. And I think we're winning that fight. We still have a few years to go in this fight as well, but I think it spells that there's a potential new golden age, because the internet originally in the early days was a golden age, and then it became towers, so to speak, and communities and list community building, which is, it's another way of turning humans into livestock in terms of your news cycle. Whose news cycle are they getting? What information do they not have access to? And I think we're getting back to a meritocracy, so to speak. We're not there. We'll see how things go. But I think it's the effort moving forward. Now, what are some of the habits? Because you've helped with some digital transformation. Again, you've helped massive growth of certain companies. What are some of the habits that you feel have helped you best on your path to success? You talked about skills and behaviors, constantly learning to be resilient, adaptable, having grit. But what about specific habits? Are there daily, weekly, quarterly habits that you think have helped you?
I think the habits of learning would be number one. So you gotta, like I said, every day ask yourself whether you are learning something new. I think the habits of really questioning what's mainstream thinking is also important. So people will come and say, that's like that. And then you're like, why? And then one thing that always helped me in a way is because many times in my life, I found myself as being an outsider coming from out of the field. And then, for instance, when I got into business aviation, I came from technology for financial markets. And then it gave me a different perspective. So people would say, no, it's like that. Then you're like, why? No, but so questioning it will allow you to see different solutions to problems people didn't see. And I think that's important. Then I think another habit is surround yourself with good people. There are studies, and I'm not saying there is a causation, but there is a correlation. People, they tend to become or to be like the five or seven people they most interact with, right? So look close at the people you're interacting with. Are they people that will lift you up, right? And then are they people that you need to feel a bit uncomfortable? You need to feel like, wow, this guy, he knows his stuff. Or look how fantastic. I'm not talking about work only. The guy's a great painter. Maybe the guy does something fantastic. So I work with a guy, he's 71 or 72, sharpest mind. He works in infrastructure. Every day he gives me a different pearl. He's got his own character, but every day he's got a different pearl, and you're learning from just by being around. So that I think that's an important habit as well. And if I could say, then again, it may not work for everybody, but exercising is good. I find that many of the good breakthroughs that I've had in my life thinking were either walking or running and I think that's important. Again, it may work for some people, it may not work for someone.
No, I think it's important. They've done all sorts of studies that people who are physically fit score better on tests, and that if you do a 10-minute walk before you do an exam, you're likely to get a better score. And it just makes pure logical sense. Your brain is fed more oxygen, more fuel. If your software is what you know, the hardware is your physical state of fitness. If all you can do is run 1 kilometer, 1 mile, and you're exhausted, you need to take a nap. That's your energy gas tank you bring to every day. But now if I snap my fingers and you can run 10 kilometers without being tired, at the end, you're like, oof, that was a good run. But you don't need to nap, essentially. You've 10x'd your energy level that you bring to everything, your ability to focus. All that, I really am a firm believer in that most people don't realize that they could upgrade their lives by upgrading their fitness habits, by, like you say, by walking. First off, things that don't move have smaller brains. Straight out, when you look in the animal kingdom, things that don't move have smaller brains. If you have a car, but it's not going to drive anywhere, you don't need wheels, you don't need an engine, you don't need an exhaust pipe, you don't need turn signals. You maybe don't need windshield wipers. Do you really need a horn? So our brains are activated, and there's a lot of transferable skills. When I was in Japan, in Tokyo, one of my students was a neuroscientist, and she was studying overlap, meaning of brain areas. And I'm making this up, but it's just as an example. Let's say the area of my brain, again, making this up. Let's say the area of my brain that controls moving my right-hand fingers is also the one where language grammar is stored in my brain. Does improve my motor control of my hand, improve my ability. I don't know more grammar, but does it improve my ability to understand, grasp concepts easily, and draw from that part of my brain better? And the answer, as far as what I understood, is yes. That's really it. It's the, what kind of knife are you bringing to the fight? You know what I mean? And so by improving yourself, it will make you better. It will make everything better. It will make your retention of thoughts and ideas better. It will make your creativity better. It will make your emotional resilience better. truck drivers, they legally in most countries have to get a certain amount of rest. They can't just drive 24 hours a day because there are studies that if they don't get enough rest, it's the equivalent to being intoxicated. So if you're on this hustle culture, sleeping 4 hours a night, it's stacking day of drunken decisions on top of day of drunken decisions. And if you have 365 days, you talk about compound effect, compound interest. What is the compound interest of making drunken business decisions 365 days in a row because you're running on E? It's better to show up at your best every day. And I think that you'll do better. And people will want to be around you. You'll be more magnetic. You'll be less likely to make stupid mistakes. I'm on a bit of a soapbox, but I love that you said that. The other thing you said,
you'd be happier as well. I think you'd be happier. I think that there is an element that go, for me at least it works, I go for a quick run, you have this charge of endorphin in your blood, then suddenly you're smiling, because people like myself included, sometimes you get grumpy, is the project that's late, is you got that customer that just complained too much, and sometimes you're just grumpy. When you do that, you become a better person to be around, and I think that helps, because people want to be around positive people, and then the exercise can help you to be more positive. That's what I
100%. You feel better. You feel better. It makes you better. If you could snap your fingers and increase your back squat, your deadlift, your 10-minute mile time, your range of motion, if I just snap my fingers and upgrade that, everything in your life would improve. Your relationships would improve. Your feelings about yourself would improve. Your mood would improve. The amount of energy and dedication focus you can bring to your events would improve. I'm not a fitness trainer. I don't sell fitness programs. For me, it's just like the bedrock of life. When you look outside, a couple of things I grew up with. Once I remember sitting in Canada, looking outside, seeing the squirrels, and it was a weekend. I was like, oh, those squirrels don't get a weekend. And it dawned on me, that's like a social construct. Like the birds and the bees, they don't get to go, hey, cat, I'm on my Sunday. Can you come try to eat me tomorrow? They don't have technology. They don't have fridges. They're not going to go, hey, I'm just not going to work today. Whatever. I don't want to eat. Yeah, I'm just going to skip today. Who needs to eat? Whatever, predators, I'm taking a mental health day. Like that just is nonsense. That's a social construct that that's not a real thing in life. That's a luxury that we have. And it's okay to take it. I'm not saying don't take it. I'm just saying acknowledge it for what it is. And then I really think that there's more money in sick people than healthy ones. So you have to be aware, not everything in the jungle kills you and eats you. Some things feed on you as long as they can. Look at cigarettes. Cigarettes are prevalent worldwide. What's the benefit? Is there any benefit? There's no benefit to cigarettes. People are like, oh, I go outside, I calm down. You calm down because you left the situation, you got sunshine and fresh air, and you took deep breaths for 10 minutes. That's what fixed your mood. It's not the nicotine, but it's there, and it's a pure parasitic thing in our society. I was a smoker for a number of years. So that's why I talk about, there's real things that I think that people miss out on. And so anyway, I digress. One thing I do want to mention, I know we're getting up on time, but you mentioned like listening to multiple sides of an issue. I thought that was really important. I think that anytime an important issue comes up that I agree with you 100%, and some of the people I respect most, one of them said, I always look for the voice of contrarian reason. Whenever I am so sure in an opinion and I hear something else and I immediately disagree with it, I'll stop myself and I'll do research until I feel I discover the voice of contrarian reason. So maybe somebody disagrees with something, but you get to the root cause of why there's that disagreement. And you look at the whole data set. Because if you have incomplete data, then you are making false presumptions, right? And not based in reality. And I think that was a fantastic tip. I got one more question I think I want to ask. And that's, what future trends do you see coming down the pipeline for your industry and the world, at least, that you are keeping tabs on and that you think the listeners probably should be paying attention to as well? Next 5, 10 years.
Yeah. So before I just go on that one, you made me remember an interesting quote as well about what you just said. I think that listening to other people's opinion is so important, because I think there's a quote from, I think it's Mark Twain, says that what gets you in trouble is not the stuff you don't know, it's the stuff you think they weren't sure anyway. So I think that sometimes we really think something is in a certain way, and then we just didn't know that it wasn't that way. And then you need someone else with a different perspective. So I think that's very powerful. So just closing that parenthesis there. Back to the future. I think what's going to shape a lot of businesses in our lives, I don't want to be repetitive, but it's going to be AI. I think we have a lot of the concepts that we are leveraging now, they haven't been invented yesterday. Neural networks been around for a while. A lot of the technology is around for a while, but the conditions weren't never quite so right as they are right now. So the availability of computing, the availability of data, the connectivity across devices, so many things, like all the moons are aligned. And I think that this shift to a data-driven society is just happening. And I'm in a way, I'm super happy because in my generation, I managed to live through a few very important, very consequential shifts. The internet in the 2000s, mobile computing in the 2010s. And then we're talking about many automation just after, and now AI, and it's happening. And I'm talking about AI, but it's as if it's, you know, it's more of the same, but it's not. If you really take a step back, it's already permeating a lot of our day to day. You go on a website, there is likely to be a recommender system there, helping you select what it is you will buy in your house. But this, at least here at home, we have this little robot that does the cleaning for us. At home, you just press the button. It learns from the surroundings, the places, and then it adapts based on that. It predicts where it should be going next. It's all about prediction. AI is about bringing down the cost of prediction, right? The car, the autonomous car predicts where it has to go, whether it has to stop or continue based on the data it receives. To me, that's going to be really a shift. It's mind blowing. I have always been involved in technology. I'm involved in AI since many years. And it's difficult not to get impressed by the accuracy of these algorithms these days. So I think that is what I think is going to be shaping our future. Is it going to be changing everything? Are we going to be heading to Armageddon? And I mean, some people are talking about it, yes or no. I don't know. It's beyond my pay grade to say it. But what I would say is it's changing people's lives. And how you react to it, and I'm talking about both businesses and professionals, is going to make a huge difference. For instance, businesses that leverage those tools will be ahead of the pack, yeah. Right? Businesses that don't will not. Right now, if you're not using any kind of co-pilot in your day-to-day activity, I'm sorry, you are being left behind.
Yes.
Because talk about cyborgs, right? We are going to be enhanced by this robotic arm, which is AI helping us in many areas of our lives.
Cyborgs. I'm talking with my physical voice, but it's going through this mic. It's just clunky hardware, that's all. But you and I are talking from opposite sides of the planet. We already are cyborgs, just not under our skin. So I think that's an important thing. And what you're talking about in terms of tools, the clearest example is accounting and calculators. When calculators came out, the more productive ones became more productive. The least productive ones lost their excuse for why it took them so long to calculate numbers. And either they had to step up and try to improve, or they maybe need to find a new career because and we're entering a new phase of that. People are still going to need to eat. The world's going to still spin. Humans are still going to have goals and aspirations. Entertainment's still going to be there, but it's definitely going to be an adjustment period, 100% for sure. I think the biggest thing is we have to try to talk, have conversations like these, agree on what outcomes we want, get away from tribalism and idols, and really focus on what kind of a world do we want to shape? What does that look like? Let's define it together. And then we can talk about roadmaps to get there. I think that's a really important conversation to have. And that's part of why I've been upping how many interviews I do, is to connect with more people and put more conversations out there without censorship, without filters, all that sort of stuff, because I think that's a critically important thing in the near future, because it's just like money or a shovel or a hammer. A hammer can build a house, but it can also kill people. So it's the same sort of thing. And we're going to enter this phase where we've got new tools with almost unknown reach. I remember in the early days of Facebook, I was living in California and I woke up one day and it wasn't a healthy habit, and I've gotten out of that. This is one of those things where we have to talk about, what do we want? Like, the tools allow amazing reach here, especially with leverage. This recording, I still get downloads from interviews I did in 2016, 2015. And so that's huge leverage. This recording could go out to 10 million, 50 million, 100 million people, right? And it doesn't take any more time out of our day. But then we have to talk about what are the padded corners, so to speak, that we want on these kinds of tools and filters and that. So we're not going to solve those in here. But I did want to ask Pedro, is there anything that I haven't asked you about that I should have asked you about?
I think one last point that I think it's worth mentioning, at least for me, sharing as we're having this very nice chat, is I think a key lesson on the many scars I have gotten from delivering technology projects over time, and if I stopped that I would go back in time and do differently, I would focus as much in the how as in the what. So delivering, getting to the finish line is fundamentally important, yes. But there are different ways to go about it. And then people need to remember that an organization is something that needs to go on beyond the life of certain projects. And I think sometimes we become very energetic about our projects and people get tired after a while. So I think looking at this human element of looking after the teams and making sure that they are ready for the next challenge, even though you might go slightly slower on this one, but remember, this is a string of deliverables you want. It's not just the one project that gets delivered and afterwards you can't run anymore. Because you're flat out. So I think that to me, if I could share something that stuff that I would do differently, one thing it would be, yes, you need to have to be at the finish line. That's the deal. But you got to look into how you do that and then make sure that people get to the finish line fit for the next run.
Yeah, I love that. Well said, Pedro. If people want to follow up, if they have questions, if they want to learn more, what are some of the best ways for them to reach out and get in touch?
You can always email me. It's pedro.outlook.com, pedro.nassif, N-A-S-I-F, at outlook.com. It would be a pleasure to respond to anybody.
Got it. So that's pedro.nassif@outlook.com. Drop them an email. Let them know that you enjoyed the interview. If you have any follow-up questions, you can also look them up on LinkedIn as well. You'll find them there. Same name, pedro.nassif. Pedro, thank you again for coming and sharing with us, knowing you have your own direct reports, your own family, your own followers, your own things you could be doing. Thank you for coming and sharing with my followers and I so we can all do a little bit better.
Thank you, Darryl. It was a pleasure being here and chatting with you. Have a great day.